And anyone who, any listeners who work in kind of the UK, but also in Central Europe will appreciate, is that it is very difficult to get anything done in August, because there is inevitably, of every project, of every opportunity, of everything you are working on, there will be at least one person who's quite key, who is like, no, I'm on holiday for 3 weeks.
Yep.
Or there's the kind of like skeleton staff, shall we say, which is fine, because it's the same for my customers.
There's one guy covering the Nordics. There's one guy in Germany, maybe.
maybe.
They're spending most of their time drinking coffee and having cakes, and actually it's an ice cream at this point because it's still freakishly hot. And when they see an email coming through, they can't care less.
Yeah, and there's one person in France, but they're just working from the beach.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, they're definitely on a Riviera somewhere, yeah, having a cocktail.
Yeah, and just enjoying. And again, you know, maybe that's... I'll be honest, I remember when I first kind of got into this career, I met a guy, but he was the kind of archetype of that, like, 80s and 90s enterprise sales guy. Very, very, very good at what he does. Does not use any technology released after about 2005. Still absolutely crushes his number every year, but spends a lot of the summer on the golf course because he's like, yeah, no one's around and I'm going to hit my number anyway. And I think that is a level of confidence, I would say. Not complacency, just confidence and almost like, yeah, it's fine. I'll be good.
Yeah, I've been around the block enough to know that this works.
I pendulate between going, I want to be this super high-flying, successful person. And you know what? That lifestyle looks quite appealing. Just going, yeah, you know, I'm going to do what I do. And then the rest will take care of itself.
Just going to work out.
Yeah.
It just works.
It just works.
Tom Howard. It just works. Minute 10 of recording. I think having a gaming reference within the first 10 minutes, I think, is a personal record of mine.
I think it might be.
Paul, I haven't recorded with you for four weeks? I want to say 4 weeks too. Unexpected summer break, which now is going to become the standard.
Yes.
But yeah, 4 weeks.
4 weeks.
How are you, buddy?
I'm good, yeah.
How is life?
Life is good. and I feel like we should maybe, like, the 4 week break is one of those things where, full disclosure, I think we both were just busy and also edging, like, on the corners of burnout, and went, hey, you know what?
Mm-hmm.
We're not in the right place. And I had all intention of putting something out and telling everyone, and then I just didn't. And I think, nope, as long as everyone knows that from now on, we're going to have at least a week off in the summer. I'm good. But no, things are good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a bit tired. It's summer. It's always the thing of, like, you know, oh, summer. We were just talking a little bit about, like, you know, how people have cocktails by the beach and, you know, golfing and all those sorts of bits and pieces. For some reason, over the last couple of years, summer for me has been the busiest time of the year because it usually involves a lot of travel. And then around travel, there's also a lot of work. And it's always one of those things of, like, I think about it at the beginning of every... So we tend to plan, like, our year ahead of travel, like, at the end of the previous year. So even now, sort of like me and my partner sort of start saying, is like, oh, when do we want to go here next year? Do we want to go there next year? Do we not, you know, just to be able to, obviously with his time off, to be able to navigate that and for me to navigate around the business and everything. And every year I say this to myself very clearly, like, Lydia, you will not do a nightmare summer of travel again. You will not do it. And lo and behold, every year it still happens. So the enforced, for at least, you know, one episode skipped break, at least from the podcast, is quite a nice thing to look forward to. Because at the end of the day, as much as I enjoy doing this, and I know this is the same for you, Paul, this is first and foremost, like, quite a bit of fun for us to do. But it is still work, because we still want to provide a nice listening experience and useful and helpful and, you know, entertaining, hopefully, for some folks. So hopefully, Tim, if you're listening, please give us a heads up if this is still okay. And really, like, it still is, even after doing it for 16 episodes now, there is still a level of, oh, you know, this is still quite a bit of work. But it's a nice work. It feels good work. But having a break from time to time is also fun.
Yeah, and it is. And I think one thing I didn't appreciate when we sort of set out on this, and looking back, there was definitely a, as there was everything, is that there was like a honeymoon period when we could just kind of talk about anything and everything, and we hadn't kind of quite figured out what we wanted the show to be, and we were still sort of playing around with that format. Now, and you know, admittedly, you have a lot more that you do between us recording and it's going out than I do. There is still a mental load of getting into a headspace to record, which is, as you say, doing so in a way that is engaging and hopefully interesting and ideally entertaining. Because sure, we could kind of get on and record for 2 hours, but I really think that it was, coming back to this now, I feel refreshed and excited to do this in a way that I didn't realize I needed to kind of get back to. So that's a nice thing, in that you go, oh, actually, you know what? Yeah, aww, taking a break was nice. And we have obviously
spoken. Oh, I'm really happy to hear that.
But yeah, it's nice. It's like, oh, okay, I needed that more than I thought.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, now it's a given. No, we'll set the next time around. I think we'll just let people know, and it's not going to be a sort of a needs must break. if we have to record this week, I don't think I'll be able to wake up in the morning, sort of thing. Which sounds incredibly dramatic, very dramatic. But it was definitely one of those moments of just like, oh my goodness, that I can't think of anything worse right now than having to put the podcasting face on and do that. Speaking of that, by the way, Paul, do you have a let's say like a ritual or something that you do before we start recording?
I think well, there's the practical side, right, which is generally making sure that I just have, like, I have coffee and I have water and I kind of in that space. I guess I don't have a set ritual for recording, in the same way I don't have a set ritual for meetings. I do probably try to just, I will make myself, I've probably been out, I've gone for a walk, I've made myself a coffee, I've kind of got everything sort of set up, and I'll be like, right, I feel like I can now be relaxed. Because I think the worst thing for recording, and I would liken it to when I want to get a bit of focus work done, is having that interrupted. Because if you have that sort of flow state, and that sounds very like wishy-washy, but that sort of like focus time, if that gets interrupted by, oh, you know what, I need a drink, or I need to kind of stand up, I need to move around, it's much harder to do that, because then it sort of takes me out of that headspace. So I wouldn't say I have like a set ritual. There's almost always a text between one of us going, yeah, I'm just coming, because we're gonna record at this time, and yeah, we're just coming, and then we'll jump on and we're like, hey, let's run through these like five things before we start recording. But no, I think apart, there's not a thing. What about for you? Have you got is there a ready to record playlist that Lydia has?
Oh, I like that idea, though. I have to think what sort of music would put me in a good mood to actually talk about podcasting. Because, like, my music is very weird. Like, when it comes to, like, I don't know if we've spoken about this before, but I have an album that I, for example, used for painting. I have, like, a specific album from Poets of the Fall that just runs on repeat when I'm painting. And at one point, I just don't even listen to the music. It's just there as a background noise. But other than that, I think most of the other time, it's just incredibly heavy music, which I don't think is the right mindset to have walking into a podcast recording. I'm like listening to Disturbed, like, you know, scream in your ears that, you know, you need to change the world. Well, you know, even though now when I say it out loud, it actually is not a bad mindset to come into. It's just maybe my text would be a lot hotter if that was the case. But I think the only thing I sort of do is, obviously, same as yourself, like, for folks that are not familiar with, like, how podcasting, you know, sort of, at least that's how podcasting looks for, like, for us. We sort of sit down for between an hour and a half and 2 hours. So usually that means that we have to have plenty of hydration as we go along. Because also speaking for long periods of time does not do you well. And other than that, just depending on the topics... No, I'm just thinking about them a little bit. I do try to get a walk in usually, but sometimes, you know, life is weird and wonderful and routines don't always stick. I do like a walk usually before we start recording. But then just look through the show notes because, you know, we do have some show notes. We do a little bit of prep beforehand, some topics that we want to talk to. And it's just putting me in that sort of right set of, you know, the pattern of that I want my brain to be at. Funny story, though, when we first started recording, I was quite nervous about the way I sounded. And I thought that, you know, oh, who is this? Who is this, you know, bumbling idiot? You know, what is she trying to say here? And they're like, she doesn't know what she's talking about. I used to listen to, and this is going to sound so lame, that I listen to myself talk. I listened to like other podcasts that I have been a guest on that I think I've done a pretty good job. And I listened to that past Lydia and how she explains things and how she talks about things. And just as a, and I remember like how I felt during the recordings of those podcasts. And I'm like, that I felt the exact same way as I do now. And look how well it went. This is fine, right? Mm-hmm. You're good. Mm-hmm. You can do this. Don't worry about it. Just go on and, you know, and just do your thing. And I think that's, you know, and I love that you mentioned that you have, you know, you don't have a ritual for meetings as well, but I imagine your brain goes through like a very similar sort of like mindset shift of like, oh, I'm here to perform now. I'm here to do a thing.
Right.
So I need to get myself into like the right mindset for it.
Right. And it really does depend. And I will say that, again, it very dependent on the context. So when I was in the field and I was doing lots of customer facing presentations, and if there was a big one coming up, you know, I would be as the heavy music, right? It kind of to kind of get that. I think if I had a sense of needing to somehow either distract myself or amp myself up, and it would quite often end up being the same stuff that I work out to, which is stuff that I only ever listen to really in the gym, and it's like I'm not that angry. I'm really not that angry. But if I listen again,
no, I wouldn't describe you as an angry person.
No, but if I listen to it before the podcast, it would bring a very different vibe, right? Like I think if I'm there kind of just listening to, you know, just a little bit of Knock Loose before we get on, I'm gonna be a different person kind of coming into this call. So it's just important, I think, to like come in with like that kind of, yeah, like blah, blah, blah. But you know, for certainly going into big presentations or meetings, either and now a lot more of that happens internally rather than externally. Yep. So if I know that it's a big meeting with senior people in the organization or to a large audience, I will kind of go through a bit of a like a warm-up. I have in the past done, I think, and again this was more of an on-site thing, I have been known to do vocal warm-ups before presenting, because I think
yeah, but you have a theater background, right. So
yeah, but I think
you know this sort of stuff.
I do. It's things like how you project and going through that, being very aware of how I'm speaking. And I think I come to the podcast with a similar mentality, which is I'm more considered about how I speak and the words that I use and the structure of my sentences. And I try to not do that thing that you know that I do all the time in real life, which is I fail to finish a thought. Like every third thought I have, I sort of fail to finish it and then jump to something else and then go, oh, that thing I was talking about, just kind of circling back around to it. So I think I trying to get myself in that headspace. And interesting you mentioned show notes, because I have probably in the last year, I would say, started using speaker notes a lot more, because I've...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think it came out of a feeling that I needed to be tightening up my presentation.
Right. So it was a time thing where you had like less time than you want.
Yeah. And about time, and also wanting to be more concise in my messaging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like a lot of people, when you first, particularly in solutions engineering and in this kind of space, particularly if you know the product as I did, you just wing it for like initially, you go, yeah, it's fine. I'll just wing it. And I've kind of now come right around to going, no, I'm actually going to like structure out my script and my flow, because then I know I'm hitting all the points. But it also just helps me sort of anchor that timing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You sort of raised this topic. It was actually one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. So I had a 2-week, as you know, because we've spoke about this off air, but for folks listening, I did have my first 2-week long course for a UK customer. And it went really well. Everyone's really happy. I'm really happy with it. And then a lot of really interesting topics came up from speaking to the pre-sales team there. And one of the things, and it was such a lovely conversation, because the lady that I was talking to was incredibly bubbly, incredibly enthusiastic about her space and the things that she was doing. But one of the things she spoke to me about was, she spoke to me about, like, as she was telling her stories to me, I kept on catching the thing she kept on saying, like, oh, I was so scared before I started talking. Oh, so anxious. I was riddled with anxiety. Like, I couldn't sleep the night before. Which, first of all, I understand completely, because I'm the absolute same. if there is any big event that you ever see me speak at, just so you know, that I have not slept the evening before, as a standard. I've done that since a child. I just don't do well with stress and sleep. But as I was listening to her, I asked her, like, so what are, is there something that you do to sort of try to alleviate that stress? Is there, do you have some helpful materials? Do you take some notes on a piece of paper before you go on stage? Is there, you know, do you have speaker notes? Anything like that? And she's like, well, no, not really. And at that point, I actually, I don't, that's why I find it strange that you are doing speaker notes. But again, I guess it's a tool. It depends on how people use it. In my experience, people who have speaker notes, because I used to be like that as well. If you have speaker notes, you tend to lean on them a little bit more than you should. Mm-hmm. They are a little bit like crutches. And I've seen people time and time again do a fantastic job at presenting. And then they sort of go like, ooh, I have presenter notes. Let me just have a peek. Oh, I forgot this one thing. And it sort of really ruins the flow of what they were saying.
No.
Right? So it's that sort of like reference back to it. So actually what I suggested to her, because I didn't want to suggest, especially someone relatively new to the pre-sale space, you know, someone that's new to being a solutions consultant, it was one of those things where I said like, whilst I think presenter, as and you explained it as well, whilst there is a place and time for presenter notes, the recommendation I gave her is write out only the beginning of each section.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have, obviously you would prepare, you know, especially if it's a demo or like a well-known content that you're going to be doing, that sort of a free-form speech that you're doing, you will have an idea of how long each section takes. So you sort of like time yourself vaguely, or if you have a timer or you just have a clock that you're looking at just to know where you are when it comes to time, only write down the beginning of the section and memorize that. Because once you get that initial, or, you know, you get over the initial bump on the road of like, okay, this is how we start this section. In this section, we're going to talk about yada, 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 yada.
Mm-hmm.
And then because you've done it so much already, you know what you're doing. This is not your first presentation. Your brain finds those pathways throughout to lead you to where you need to go anyway. And I'll be honest with you, and that was something I told her as well. Only you know what you wanted to tell people. So even if you missed something that you think is fundamentally important, but the time has passed, the topic has passed, you can always circle back around at the end to sort of say like, oh, and just as a reminder, this is something that I think is quite important for the topic that we're discussing today. So when we were discussing this specific function or feature, this is the thing that I wanted to highlight to you guys. It's the last thing before we end up, right? People would have no idea that your intention was to say it during that section. They would think that was intentional. So really, like, that's why, like, again, presenter notes for me, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. It can be really useful. It could be, and I think, again, maybe not in the beginning when you first really start off your career, maybe when you get into a leadership position and when you have a lot less time to actually present, you have a lot less attention span, maybe it's a little bit different. I don't know. What do you think?
So I think I would probably, for me, offer a distinction between presenter notes and having your script written out. What I don't do, and I've seen people get this wrong so many times, is when you write out what you're going to say and then you read it, because it is the most obvious thing. It is.
Yeah.
It just sat, and there are people who I've seen do it in context, and it's particularly a problem remotely. And you can just tell that when they get interrupted, they struggle to then get back on. And that's something I've never done, is, you know, tried to write out my entire script. It's always been bullet.
See, I did. I did at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. So when I was learning the content, when I was learning the product, I felt like I needed that. So I was actually scripting out what I wanted to say. It was also a way for me to, like, back to the topic of being succinct. I knew how many words I speak per minute. Mm. And I knew that if I have, let's say, you know, and I started at, you know, I had a 45 minute demo, thus I have 45 minutes of content. That over time, I realized it needs to be a lot shorter. But that was an experience thing that took me a while to figure out. But I did get there eventually. But I did it as the beginning, just so I know, more of as a to prove to myself that I do have the things in my head to actually be able to present this to people.
I think I spent a time in a world where the adopted methodology was following a script, giving a demo, and mm-hmm. I really struggled with that, because firstly, it kind of pushed me down a path of feature function, and it made it really hard to come back into. And it was a very complex product, but it just felt unnatural to do. And I think I've now come around to a happy medium, and I think One thing I did take away, and actually I would say is a recommendation, particularly if you're showing something that, and this is a really great on-site thing I noticed, is actually to, when you're doing a dry run yourself, is going through and screenshotting every screen you're going to show and dropping that into a PowerPoint mm-hmm. presentation is like the ultimate backup for even more. I mean, either that or a video. I mean, I've used video as well. Having some kind of backup was useful. And again, having like a script layout where you have those using those screenshots and having the kind of points you want to make alongside those is useful to do. And I think when I was learning it, you know, to the point of having what I would consider almost stage direction. Click here.
Yeah.
Say this, click here. So kind of to your point of mm-hmm. writing out the first thing and maybe the first and the last thing. Interestingly though, I don't have speaker note really when I'm doing presentations live, and I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the performing arts background part of it. I think some of it is the adrenaline that you get when you're presenting in front of people more than you do when you're doing it remotely, and you are more economical in the words that you use when you're speaking to a group of people live than you are remotely, because remotely you're sort of detached from your audience. So I think that's where I've kind of found that happy medium. And it's interesting that I can't imagine ever writing out a script personally. I can see why you did it. I can understand why people do it. But it's just like, oh, that just feels like something I couldn't ever, you know.
Well, mind you as well, when you imagine writing out a script, it was mostly me dictating, right? So I was using dictation on my Mac to actually write out the words, because all I was wanting to see is that if I keep on talking on this topic, is it going to hit the number of words that I was expecting to have?
Mm-hmm.
And I was, again, it was, and mind you, I never used that script actually during the presentation. I never looked at it. I never read it. It was more as a tool to prove to myself that I can say the things that I wanted to say. Nothing else, nothing more. It was, I think also, when you say like the whole like stage direction thing of like, click here, do this, do that. So that was something that, we did have at VMware, we had the sort of standard slides that most of us would like pick and choose and whatever, but it was quite useful because it gave you a glimpse into how your colleagues would do it.
Mm.
And you can steal some ideas, you can take some things. And I think the important part there, and back to the conversation I was having with the folks when I was doing the training, it has to come from a fellow pre-sales person, not from the product development team.
Yes.
Or the product manager or whomever it is that actually, the product is their baby. Right, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. they would want you to tell about all of the awesome things that the product has.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what your potential prospects care about.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care about how awesome the product is. They care how this awesome product can make their lives more awesome. Not the other way around, right?
Yeah.
And I think that was, again, in that training session, I did realize that most of their training materials came from the people developing the product. Like, yeah, of course, you guys are going to have a challenge switching to a more value-based selling if you are getting your feedback in your training from the people who only know the product. And that's completely, and that's no, you know, it's not a negative thing toward the product. People should care about the product. That's what they're there to do.
They should.
But it's then our job as pre-sales and the go-to-market, you know, overarching team is to take those amazing features and functions and align them with what our prospects and customers actually want.
Yeah.
And there lies your, you know, if there was a perfect script or a perfect speaker note set, there it is.
Yeah.
But it does take a while, and it does take a lot of effort, and someone who, well, the test bunny, really. You do need someone to first go in and do it for the first time and see how it flies. And if it's good, great. If it doesn't, well, back to the drawing board.
And I think one other thing, I guess, has signed sort of a sidebar or coda to this is I feel like from having seen, and I appreciate you've never seen me present to an audience, but having seen you present, we have a similar approach to how we utilize visuals in presentations mm-hmm. in that they are in your case, literally an illustration, but they are there to enhance the message that you're giving. They're not there to give the message itself. And I think that I did some training a couple of months ago internally, and I think in the slides that I use, I think that it was an hour long session, and there were 10 slides. I think two of them had words on. The rest were all just images, just two.
Yeah.
And it's something that I did when I was at university, and I did a lot of what I called the picture quote slides, which is quote from book I'm talking about, picture illustrating the idea. Quote from film, picture from that scene. Because what that does is kind of anchors an idea in your audience's mind, and they go, oh right, I kind of understand. And then you talk to that. And I also found, and have found continually, to give you a real example, a lot of the time when I'm talking about the buying experience in B2B, I always relate it back to going and buying a car from a dealership. And you illustrate that literally with a photo of a car dealership. But I know now, I've done that enough that I put that picture up and I'm like, oh, okay, I know what the story is I'm telling here. And I don't tell it. And I think it helps to just kind of, it uplifts what you're saying. It doesn't tell you, it doesn't sort of give that message. It doesn't have a ton of words on the screen that your audience have, because then they're trying to read the screen and they're not listening to you.
Yep. My rule of thumb was always, and this is, it's far more applicable now when I'm doing training, but it was also incredibly applicable when I was doing demonstrations of a technical product, is because if my slide looks more like a PDF file, I am just going to send them a PDF after the call.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't want to do is for people to read as I am explaining things to them, because that's what I will do when humans, and it's a completely normal human nature thing, you see you see text on the screen and you want to read because, oh, what does it say, right? It's we have been programmed that way now over so many years that, hey, this is, if it's on the screen, it is important, I need to look at it. And especially if you're following best practices with it being, you know, big and bold and sort of like, you know, taking people's attention, it's like, yeah, but they're not listening to you at that point, which is, you can say, and I have had to do this on a couple of times when I really had to make a point across for a specific feature or function, I would leave the text on screen and go like, folks, I will read this out loud now for you because this is really important. And I would read out the sentence and I would say, okay, I'll give you a second to read it out yourselves as well, because if you leave from this session with this one thing, I really think that it should be this one thing. So there is definitely a time and place for like relatively word heavy slides or you know, but it's also a tool. Right? Same as the images that both you and I use, same as like the illustration, same as colors and, you know, grabbing people's attention. It's both a science and a little bit of an art, but I truly believe that there is also a place for word-centric slides in a way. But it just has to be, you have to be really careful. Again, at the end of the day, my rule of thumb was, if it can be a PDF, it's going to become a PDF and it's going to be sent as additional collateral information afterwards. And that's it. It does not belong in my slides, and I don't want to spend, whilst it's useful information, it's not critical and decision-enhancing information that I need to provide to them right now. Which, by the way, for the technical folks listening, that included configuration, settings, things that are like lines of code that was really important to my customers. But guess what? What you don't want them to do is take screenshots as you're explaining. You want them to have a nice little document that you can literally take the text that you have on that slide, because again, we got most of our slides from product management. So you take those really useful snippets of code, you put them in a nice PDF, you wrap them up, put a title on that says it specifically for them, and ship it their way. They will be much happier than having to dig through your slides to find that useful piece of information.
And I was something that I only did it maybe once or twice, because it's one of those things that I was, oh, this is a, I had a light bulb moment, and I'd done kind of what you're describing, leave behind documents, which a former boss of mine used to call them. I think a great, this idea that you take a pack, and if you're going on site, that's a printed pack of all your kind of content, or if you're doing it remotely, something you email out, so it's sending out the slideware or a PDF as a PDF. But I also did once or twice and found this super effective. I stole the idea actually from when I was on a committee of a club, of a sport club. And we used to have committee meetings every month. And we had a new chair, and they took this thing and they said, right, here, they'd been pretty senior in a company, and they started running these meetings like a board meeting, in that they sent reading material ahead of time and went, here is everything we're going to discuss. Please read it, because we will not be going through it in the meeting. And they said, you would start and you go, right, everyone's had the pack. You should have read through it. You know, it's there. We're now going to start a discussion. And I only did that a couple of times with customers, but it is super effective when you go, hey, everybody, here is just like, you know, a page or two, just a bit of a primer on what we're going to talk about. So you've had an idea. Yep. You have an idea about what our product does and about the kind of conversation we're going to have. And then you get into the meeting and you have a much more productive conversation, because you're not introducing all those ideas as a brand new.
All at once. And you left them to marinate a little bit before you actually start. Because what you really want during those meetings especially initial meetings with prospects, I think that's the most critical point. You want the conversation. You don't want want a presentation. You want to get as much from them as they will get from you, in the sense of because you're still, especially those first couple of meetings with the initial stakeholders, you're doing your own figuring out if this prospect will actually buy from you, if the product actually is a good fit for them, right? It's still very much a discovery session, and that's why I'm a big one of the conversation again. I'll keep on referring back to these 2 weeks because I think they were absolutely fantastic as a prompt to a lot of conversations that you and I tend to have. There was a question from the group there, which is, when do we switch between discovery and presenting? And my take is, you never stop discovering. You never do, because even if you, and not in the sense of like you have a list of questions that you have to ask every time, because that's frustrating. Because can you, again, to your analogy with the car, can you imagine if you're going in to buy a car and, you know, and you're going to have a couple of meetings because you want something very specific, very, you know, customized to you, which most software is to specific companies. Imagine that every single time you walk in, they start going like, okay, so what type of miles are you doing per year? Okay, so what type of color do you like? Oh, so what type of engine are you looking for? So how many seats do you need? How many? Can you imagine, like, every, and you do this 5 or 6 times, and in the 6th time, you're like, I don't want to talk to you anymore. You're a robot that is just taking my information every single time. So that's not the type of discovery I'm referring to here. I'm talking about that constant questioning from your side as a solutions consultant. Does this still fit them? Has something changed in the meantime? Because I've literally had this. I've had a customer that I was speaking to for weeks, showing off different features and functions and discussing how it's going to fit in with their entire setup. And then in two days' time, from one meeting to another, something dramatically changed in their environment. It was actually like a new security requirement came in from government, and they said, like, actually everything we spoke about so far doesn't apply anymore. So everything I had prepared and everything, whoop, off the window it went. It's like, okay, we're back to discovery now. Yeah, 6 meetings down the road. But it is what they needed, and it is what needed to happen for that deal to actually go through.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you have stories like this as well.
I do, and I've had somewhere I think everybody has had these where you get right down and you think, great, we're at negotiation, and then they come up with one, like, there was one customer in particular I can think of, and it was memorable for a lot of reasons, a lot of it because of the country I had to go to, and this is a story, if it's not one for the podcast, but if we ever meet in real life and we grab a beer, ask me about the story about my most insane business trip, given that this happened at the start of March 2020, is like the kind of, it is the least kind of crazy part about it. It's the trip that ended with me taking 4 flights in one day. It was a time, but this was like, we went on site, we were presenting to the board, we had the CEO, we went out, we had very old school, we had dinner with the kind of the SVP who was going to sign off, and we were like, yep, full negotiation. Then kind of COVID happened, that put a pause on things. We re-engaged about 3 months later, and there was a brand new requirement that had since come up, and we were like, we don't do that. And it at that moment, that deal went away. Now we have continued to speak to them, and I think it's interesting because, as you say, we've all had those stories where, like, something comes out of the woodwork, or a new stakeholder comes in and they go, yeah, but we need this. And you go, well, that's not what we've been talking about. And I think the problem with that situation, and I've had to deal with it myself, and I've seen many people, and I'm sure many people listening in go-to-market will feel this, is you then run into a situation where you obviously want to get the deal, but you can't do so in a way that is going to deliver something that particular customer needs. And you have to just go, right, we have to throw everything out that we did before in terms of what we were going to provide for you, but let's continue the conversation. And I think I agree completely with your point about discovery being an ongoing process, because you have to look at it as, is this something that is going to be mutually beneficial for both companies, particularly in a subscription recurring revenue based world.
Yep.
When it was perpetual software, not to tar from the same brush, but you could pretty much set and forget. You could do $1 million, take your commission, go and buy a Porsche, and kind of not care what happened. That world is gone. It is so much more about, and discovery is so, and I don't even know now, like, discovery feels like an insufficient description of what we now need to do in these conversations.
Ooh, That's a good point. Yeah, I think there is some weight that comes with, like, some baggage that comes with discovery.
Yeah.
I think that's why we still have conversations around, oh, but, and again, that's where also the questions I was getting during that training came from, because, like, oh, but we're expecting from our account managers, also, how cute is that? Like, the pre-sales team was like, yeah. we expected from the account managers to come in with a full list of, like, you know, requirements and everything else that's going to be perfect for us just to go in and do a demo. And I'm like, oh, you sweet summer child. But I think that's sort of like that baggage that word discovery comes from, because in a traditional sales cycle, you know, having that initial discovery is where you validate if this mm-hmm. is a customer that we can actually sell to. And at that point on, from the sales perspective, there is no more discovery. It's just mm-hmm. one big discovery at the beginning that might be, you know, your SDR, your BDR, or even an account manager that does this job. And then from that point on, when you get into actually do the quote unquote technical win, you're trying to achieve that, there is no more space for discovery, because that should have been done, like, you know, three sections in Salesforce before that. But in the reality of the world is that it's not as, and I think you're right, it might be from that sort of perpetual licensing sales cycle that used to be the case, because it was a one and done. It was a clear list of requirements, but folks, especially when it comes to subscription, folks' requirements constantly change and drift, especially as it is the technical market right now is very volatile. These things change overnight sometimes. So it would be incredibly beneficial for, I would say, one of the most valuable people on that sales team, alongside with the account manager, is the pre-sales person. It's also your job to constantly validate your own product against what the customer needs, because your product changes overnight because of the way, you know, agile development and, you know, constantly adding in new features and changing things, re-architecting things. You know, these things change, and mm-hmm. you're getting that information in real time. Mm-hmm. But also from the customer side of things, their requirements change all the time as well. So I don't really see how we can really, and I don't know if a new term is what we need, or a revamp of the word discovery. Maybe jazz it up, make it a little bit sexier, because it's not just a list of questions. It is about that constant conversation and discussion we're having. But I don't know if there's a different term. You know, English limits me here. Like, considering how do you describe this constant conversation you're having with people, this constant validation? Mm. Is it the discover? You know, discover in perpetuity? Like, do you constantly, like, have to be doing discovery?
Yeah, maybe. And I think you hit the nail on the head there when you're like, it's a step in Salesforce that we check the box and it's one and done and you move on. And that is so much. And I think, you know, we both kind of have straddled that, you know, switch from perpetual to subscription. When I was started in pre-sales, like, you could buy subscription software. It was kind of still sold like perpetual, but my biggest early deals were all perpetual licensing, and yeah, they were sold that way and structured that way. And I think now, you know, I kind of grew up as subscription was kind of growing up. And I think that this also starts to then bring in another topic that we can kind of get into, which is the role of solutions and solutions consultant. And I think this is also where this discovery piece comes in, because maybe there isn't a better word. Maybe discovery and exploration. Again, English is a language where we have a word that's spoken the same way, spelt three times, and it means three very different things. and it catches many native speakers out, because you could say they're over there with their sister, and you're like, what does that mean? But it's three different spellings, and you write that out, and I can guarantee there'll be many people who are native English speakers that will spell them wrong. So I think you're kind of right that there's a limitation, and maybe it's not the word, but it is, I think, the perception of what that is, and it's the perception of what that role is, alongside a recognition that looks very different depending on what it is you're selling and what it is you're delivering.
Mm. The other thing is, and I will mention friend of the show, Mark Green, I remember when he first shown me, and this is a couple of years back now, where he first shown me from his own experiences and his own research, the because we especially as people within pre-sales, we're quite familiar with the sales process, right? You know, the different stages and how does it look like. At the very least, when you were forced to go into Salesforce by your account manager or your leader who decided that, you know, pre-sales now need to use Salesforce as well, you have seen that very linear pattern of these are the steps we need to take for a deal to come through. You know, and you weave the magic wand in the end and money comes through into the business. Fantastic. Everyone gets paid. Mark Green did a really amazing job of switching it around and trying to create the buyer journey and the buyer experience in relationship to what it looks like to us from the seller side. And I remember just how incredibly overwhelmed I was by, one, how many more steps they have along the way, and also how drastically different they were to ours. Just completely different worlds. And I think that disjointness and that lack of visibility, because like I would, if it wasn't for Mark and having those conversations with him, I wouldn't have known. Nobody teaches you this stuff. And I think that's where you really get that realization that things like discovery, things like these discovery conversations and discussions that go throughout, you really start understanding what is your true value. You know, I know you're sort of like, we're dipping our toes into like this much deeper conversation about what is the role in you know, the role of the go-to-market team that pre-sales is a part of, but really that understanding of the person on the other side of the Teams call, the Zoom call, whatever, where they're in their journey. And mind you, most of the time they don't know that they are in that part of their journey. They're gonna potentially buy software once in their tenure in that company, maybe twice, depending on their role. But they don't have a Salesforce to open up and go like, oh yeah, so we're in step 13 of our buyer journey, right? That's not a thing they do. It is your job to figure out where it is, where they are in those many steps, to then align with your own sales process to be able to. And I think that's why I don't really subscribe to that selling process, and I never did, and I think it took me a while to sort of realize and have the words and the perspective that I have nowadays. And again, it's a lot, you know, thanks to people like Mark who have taught me so many about like from what it looks like from the other side, because I never bought software, right? I've never been on the customer side. I've always been on the partner/vendor side of things. So really, if you don't seek it out yourself, it's really, really hard to find a different perspective and to shift your way of thinking. But it's a really tricky one overall, I think. And I don't know if English is the only problem we have in this situation.
No, it's not. This is a whole other topic that we could go into in a lot of detail. I suppose for me to kind of put some kind of closure on it for now, I would say I think there's starting to be a recognition that the buying process and the selling process will look different every single time, and you need to be kind of aware of that, and that you cannot force everybody down the same path, because not everyone will be going through the same criteria. And the challenge with that is it's much, much harder to navigate, because there's a lot more unknown. There's known unknowns in every, like, if we go through a kind of a conventional sales cycle, there's a lot of known unknowns. There's things that you know you don't, right? And that's where the kind of checkbox discovery comes. But when you start to, as you're framing it, they're flipping it around to the buyer side, there's a lot of things that you don't know that you don't know that. There's a lot of factors that you don't, that you're not aware of. And you have to start considering that. And I think it's also about recognizing that the role of pre-sales, solutions consulting, solution engineering, call it what you like, of go-to-market is going to look very different in different companies selling different types of products. And it's a fallacy to me to say this is the future of the role and this is how it will always look, because that, you know, it might work. What works for a small, fully SaaS, software driven product selling to software companies for a particular niche is not going to work in enterprise software, is not going to work in infrastructure, in hardware. Mm-hmm. It looks very, very different. And I think the sooner we acknowledge that, the sooner we can start to have a conversation about, okay, so what are the commonalities between all of these things, and what should we be doing to, in this new world, better enable people to buy stuff in a way that's more pleasant? Make buying suck less, right?
Put that on a t-shirt. Another topic that came up during my 2-week training, which I think it's a little bit of a hot topic for us at the moment, which is a dress code.
Yeah.
How to phrase this? What is your default uniform when you go to a customer, like when you were a field SC?
Yeah.
What was your default uniform when you went to meet a customer in person?
So I've got a story about this. That I teased you about last night. So, I'll answer the question, then I'll tell you my story. So, for a long time, my default uniform, let's say, was smart shoes, smart trousers, button-down shirt, jacket. And I never wore a tie when I was a field SC. I had done in previous kind of office jobs in very like formal kind of old school environment. Never wore a tie. Probably more recently would change out like shirt trousers for smart jeans. I think probably when I was doing like kind of field, when I've been most recently fit. Weird enough, actually kind of post-pandemic, I feel like things have got a little bit more casual, but it was almost always the shirt and the jacket. And I would probably do for customer-facing calls, it would, again, be at minimum a polo shirt, maybe a polo shirt with like a company-branded jacket on, or it would be a button-down shirt. However, I learned a very important lesson about this, because that was my default, right? That was my default, but
yeah.
My last customer visit pre-COVID, I was going to a sportswear company, very kind of big sportswear company, and I wore that outfit to their office. And when I turned up, my colleague was dressed probably slightly more casual, I would say smart, the worst word, which is like smart casual, which in that he was in like smart sneakers, smart trainers, and like polo shirt and jeans. And then the person that came to greet us was just wearing like tracksuit. And I just had this moment of going, oh, I've screwed up. And then I sit in a room of like 10 people, the most senior person was wearing like a company branded polo shirt, jeans, and again, like the kind of sportswear equivalent of eating your own dog food, right? Wearing their own clothes.
Yep.
But I just was walking out going, I feel so out of place. So
yeah.
My default dress code was that, but I also have learned in time that you have to dress for the people you are seeing, and that varies massively.
Yes. Yeah.
What about you?
I think my uniform was even more casual, especially as someone. So first of all, you know, keep in mind, I came in as an engineer. Like the expectation of us when you were actually like a network engineer was that you looked presentable. Like you had clothes on that are not stained by coffee because you stayed up until 2 a.m. the previous night trying to solve a P1 problem. I was still in an office. So this was like before I joined VMware. Like it was still an office environment. Like, but the uniform, I would say, was jeans and a t-shirt and, you know, okay, like maybe not running sneakers, even though my boss at the time was wearing practically running shoes the entire time. The head of engineering, and that was sort of the expectation, right? That was like the stereotype that this is what the engineers look like. I remember when I wore heels a couple of times at the office, I was made fun of. I actually have a picture of me in the server room with heels on, you know, tippy toeing into like the top of the rack of trying to like reach a switch. So there, that has been documented for the records that I did wear heels once at work and never again. Because it was also, you know, a job that was quite on your feet. And guess what? You know, I don't know if you had the experience, Paul, of wearing heels. Heels are not quite, you know, they're not comfortable. Even if they tell you, like, oh, no, these are my comfy heels. Like, yeah, comfy heels are still not sneakers, right? Like, let's be very...
So just pin, yes, I do, but...
Of course, you're a theater kid. Of course, you've worn heels.
Oh, no, this... yeah, that was why I wore heels, was the theater.
I like how you didn't want to tell the story about like the pre-pandemic journey, but you were like, oh, heels though. Oh yeah, you should see me in drag. I look fantastic.
Yeah, I looked all right. there's photo evidence.
To be honest with you, usually some of the what I would consider like some of the manliest looking men I know in my life, in some circumstances I have seen them in quite feminine clothing. They always look the best for some reason, and it's incredibly frustrating as a woman to see that happening.
I did have that. Why do you have
smoother, nicer legs than me?
Uh-huh.
This is just so evolutionally unfair.
That why do you have such nice legs was a comment that I got, and I was like,
I work out.
I work out. I cycle
yeah,
a lot.
So do I.
Yeah, but there we go.
No, it's incredibly unfair. But yeah, no, heels are not the most comfortable thing. So yeah, so it was quite a casual, still, I would say not even smart casual. It was semi smart casual.
Mm-hmm.
So, and when I joined VMware, like I joined during the pandemic. So it was I remember, and bless her, like I love her so much. Like one of the account managers that was covering like the product set. She wasn't my account manager, but I obviously like we were sort of part of the same group, so same team. I always looked at her as like my fairy godmother, because when I first joined, I'm like, I have no idea what I'm doing. You know, I was preparing for like when things were opening up, I was preparing for my first meeting, and I'm like, and her name is Debbie, and I'm like, Debbie, what do I wear? Right? I have no idea what to wear. And bless her, she had like a full rundown of like, okay, so what type of customers are you meeting? So, you know, to your point about like, it really matters who you're meeting. She covered mostly at the time, she was covering quite a lot of financial customers. So she went through the whole thing of like brown shoes, brown belt, like, you know, you need to be doing this, bag needs to fit, you know, the whole like, you know, bang, 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 bang. And she was a very fashionable lady as well. And I'm looking at her and listening to her, and like my eyebrows just kept them getting higher and higher, and my eyes kept them getting bigger and bigger. And I'm like, Debbie, like I need to buy a new wardrobe. And she's like, well, who are you meeting? And I'm like, oh, because I was covering public sector. And I'm like, oh, I'm meeting some of the NHS guys. And she's like, oh, jeez, okay.
Yeah.
And in fact, that was true. Jeans were perfectly fine. I remember one time I was meeting with some guys down in London, because I tend to travel to London quite often, and I tended to do quite a lot of back-to-back meetings because it was a long trek for me.
Mm-hmm.
And one time I was going to have quite a swanky / official meeting I was having with some folks. So I went full on, you know, heels, dress, hairdo, makeup, the whole nine yards. And I remember meeting with that team, like the folks that I knew and I have met already a couple of times. And I walked into the meeting room, and they sort of looked me up and down in a casual way, not in a defensive way, but sort of looked me up and down and went like, are you going to a wedding or a funeral after this? And we were quite close, right? So they knew they could make that joke with me. And I just started laughing, and I'm like, what if I just dressed up for you guys? What would you say? And they're like, well, please don't do that again. You don't have to. And I'm like, no, it's not for you. And they're like, oh, okay, cool. We can carry on. But to your point, right? Like, so if it wasn't for that closeness with them, they wouldn't feel comfortable to sort of like alleviate that little bit of now formal stress that I sort of caused on them, you know, mm-hmm. without really meaning to, because I didn't think about it because I knew them already. So there wasn't that barrier between us. But if that was the first time we were meeting and they had no idea who I was, and if I was, especially if I was behaving in a far more formal way, I think there would be incredibly, you know, an incredible turnoff for them. And they wouldn't want to have, you know, they wouldn't be as comfortable having mm-hmm. a very open, honest conversation with me about the struggles they were facing at the time with the product set. They would see me as a, you know, well, as someone, you know, of official standing, which wasn't the case. I wanted to be their person on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
That was always my goal when I was talking to customers, and having a mismatching dress code really, really affected that. So I went through like all of my individual contributing career doing that, like dressing fairly casually, nicely but casually, right? To the point of like, you know, mm-hmm. sneakers mm-hmm. was the default shoe. Nice, clean ones, but definitely the, especially because some of the times I would be presenting and standing up for like 4 or 5, 6 hours straight, and it's like, well, yeah, I'm not gonna wear uncomfortable shoes. Nobody expected that of me. But I was debating if I should share this story, but I think it's a really good sort of story to tell for folks that do face the same circumstances, and sort of make light of myself. So that same training, the company I went to actually speak at, I wasn't informed, and the folks that organized it were incredibly apologetic about everything. But, you know, case in point, I did not get any feedback on what the dress code is.
Mm-hmm.
I was driving there the day after a very long trip. So mm-hmm. I literally, like, the evening when we got home, because it was like we got home the evening before and then I traveled in the morning. Mm-hmm. So I literally just took the clean clothes that I had with me in that suitcase, moved it onto the other suitcase, filled the car up with whatever I could think of at like 11 p.m. and just shoved everything into the back of the car, closed it down, went to sleep, had 4 hours of sleep, and just drove to site to actually do the first day of training. And then obviously that came with a lot of jokes about, like, you know, Lydia can't speak English because she's been switching between three different languages the last 2 weeks. But, you know, it was a good sort of icebreaker. But, and I went in the way that I would usually go to when I was meeting customers for the first time, when I was doing, you know, when I was at VMware, which meant nice dress, nice hairdo, nice clean sneakers, you know, mm-hmm. fairly mm-hmm. smart, right? You know, as you said, like, you know, smart trainers. And as I walked into the building at reception, there were like four lovely ladies at reception, and they looked so sharp. They looked immaculate. Yeah. Nails, hairs, heels, but like stiletto heels.
Right.
You know, the whole, yeah. Like, yeah. You know, nice. They were beautiful. And I realized at that moment, Paul, that I have made a grave mistake. Because the one thing I didn't throw in my car, which practically looked like a dumping ground at that point,
uh-huh.
is I didn't throw my pair of heels.
Oh.
And at that point, I had two options. Either I just run with it, you know,
yeah.
figuratively speaking, with my sneakers,
yeah.
or I go barefoot. There wasn't an option. There was just, well, I have to live with this. Nobody said anything to me. They were all incredibly lovely. But I had this thing at the back of my head the entire day of like, oh my Lord, I am so out of place with my brightly colored hair, with like, mm-hmm. you know, with my sneakers and this highly, highly smartly dressed environment. Everyone was suited and booted. The men all had ties and suit jackets and everything. Like, it was proper official.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I didn't get the memo, so I was like, ooh, this is not... Oh, well. Let's just say that, you know, from their perspective, I'm just the quirky trainer, right? That's what I am.
Yeah.
And I have a really good rapport with the gentleman that was that actually, you know, brought me in, and it was one of the managers, and we throughout the day, we had a really good chat, and I think we formed quite a close relationship. We were joking around, you know, sharing, you know, personal stories. It was a fantastic time. And at the end of the day, after everyone left and it was just the two of us, and we were just having like a catch-up of how the day went and all of that, and bless him, he sort of like, I could tell he was quite uncomfortable in his chair, and he was like, I don't know what's a good way to approach you on the topic, but judging from what I've seen today, you will be able to handle a little bit of direct, you know, have a little bit of a direct conversation about something. And I knew, right?
Mm-hmm.
I knew it. And I sort of stopped him and I went like, it's about the shoes, isn't it? He's like, yeah, I'm so sorry. We have a very strict dress code. And he apologized 1,000 times because he felt so bad, because he's like, I should have warned you on the email. It's not, you know, it's not something we should be expecting of people. And he was so embarrassed and so felt so bad about it, and I'm like, no, it's perfectly fine, like it's me, I'm the problem, right? And it was just this sort of like really kind of sweet, kind of awkward back and forth where like we both felt bad for the other person. And guess what, the next day I came in, I was with heels on. Like, I'm not making that mistake ever again. Those heels are now permanently living in the back of the car. It's just, yep, that's where they live now.
Yep.
But it was like, so the sort of the point of that story is to also keep in mind that like you will have your blunders.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, and I think the most important thing is to, one, be okay with that, because it will happen, right? There will always be a situation where you will misread the room, and that is absolutely fine. The way, because it wasn't like a big thing, like it wasn't that I came in with a t-shirt and shorts. If that was the case, I would, at that point, I would acknowledge it.
Mm.
At the beginning of the meeting or the beginning of the day, I would just go like, and in your situation, right? It's like, right. I would do like a funny thing just to like sort of break the ice of like, oh, let me take, like, I see I've misread the room completely.
Yeah.
I would like to apologize. Yeah. I will now do my best to keep on undressing until I fit the mood, okay? Until you tell me stop, I will just keep on doing that, right?
Yeah, I think is what I did, which is I kind of got in the room and I was like, right, jacket off, sleeves up. I'm just going to like lay back and look, try and look chilled here. Because, yeah, it was honestly embarrassing. And also I'd been on a 7 a.m. flight. So I was very tired and just not. And I was so in this like, I need to just do this thing. But yeah, we've all been there, and I think the meme that often goes around is like wearing a suit to your first day at a startup, and there's plenty of like parodies, and it's like, but like, if that's where you come from, like, what else do you know? And I think particularly in a...
And it's such a cultural thing as well, right? It's such a cultural thing. If, like, I remember when one of my first customer meetings, like, I was, as girls do, I was showing pictures to my mom. And she was quite surprised, because in Bulgaria, like, especially in an office environment, I think it obviously has changed, especially post-COVID and especially in the more technical environments, but mom was an accountant, right? So it was a very smart dress code where she was working at, so she had like a full-on like work wardrobe, which by the way I never had, right? So I never developed a work wardrobe because I never needed it.
So
I sent her a picture of like me going to my customer meeting in like a cute frilly dress and like some sneakers, and she's like, where are you going? And I'm like, to a customer meeting. And she's like, oh, okay. She didn't judge, obviously, but she was definitely like, Oh, okay. Okay, cool. Not what I expected to see, but nice.
Yeah. I mean, I did, and I went from an environment where I was kind of... It was like... You know, shirt and tie, to then one where I, for safety reasons, couldn't wear a tie and I could kind of get away with a polo shirt. And I think, again, this is actually something that's telling is this was, I was starting my career at a point where I was still interviewing face to face. So I would go in and obviously you go dress smart to the interview. And so you kind of get a read on what the dress code kind of was from the interview.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went into, again, back into a very formal, and I think I've told this story before, and I was working for a law firm, high street law firm, only for a year. But I'm glad I did it because it gave me a flavor, and they probably do still work this way now. And this is only like 7-8 years ago that I was there, but you would start work at 9, you would work through until 1, and you'd have coffee breaks, right? At 1 o'clock, everybody would go for lunch, and like the whole, like the office would go for, like everyone, lunch was 1 until 2. And, you know, because again, there would be people kind of, some people would be working, obviously like reception was still manned, and there would be some people still working, but like largely people would leave the office. They would like, going out for lunch was a thing, but you would expect, the expectation was you'd be back by 2 o'clock, and then you would finish at 5 or 5:30, right? You would you'd finish at 5.
Yeah, quite regimented, quite sort of strict.
Very regimented. And you could request, you could be like, oh, could I leave early at 4? But if you wanted to do any, there was no flexible working, no, oh, you know what, I'm going to just finish it, like, because I've got a long drive, so I'm going to finish at 1 today and then kind of catch up when I get to where I'm going. No. You worked, and if you wanted that half day, you took half a day. So, and then I kind of went back in, and then I was on site with a customer, and it was a varied kind of dress code, right? And I think it would go up and down based on who you were meeting and your role. And it was, again, more sort of like shirt. Some people dressed like would have the same thing on every day, and I think must have had like 5 iterations of the same outfit. But that was the point at which I stopped having a work wardrobe, and it really went away after COVID. Like, now I have, like,
but
enough shirts for a week, and that's
some
it.
Of the arguments, because obviously, like, that became a conversation when I was doing the training, like, the dress code and things. The folks that were happy with the dress code, some of that was they believed that going to a customer meeting, suited and booted, gave the customer a level of confidence that these people are serious, that they know what they're doing, that they're very professional, and, you know, that they can be trusted to actually do the thing. And whilst I agree with them to a certain degree, if your idea as a pre-sales consultant to go in and to be the authority figure, which is what usually that sort of, you know, overly formal dress code provides, if that is your goal, then absolutely, that is what you should be doing. But then my argument was, is that really what you guys want to be perceived at?
Yeah.
Or do you want to be perceived as a trusted advisor, a friend, someone that they can actually have open conversations about, or someone that they should fear and respect? And I think I sort of left them with that thought to consider, what is the imagery and the impression? And again, there's always exceptions, right? So some of the folks that I was speaking to were working with financial institutions, which is like, that's a given, right? Or law firms, right? Like, if you are going to be talking to people whose general, their profession requires that of them, then of course going in, that's why, like, for example, if I was going to be covering, like when I was an individual contributor, if I was going to be covering financial customers, I was going to get a working wardrobe, right? That's a given. Like, brown shoes, brown belts, like, I was going to fit the bill because that's what they expect of you. But your general small to medium business, and even enterprises, right? Like, depending on their flavor, that might actually play against you, because again, you might make them uncomfortable with that level of suited and booted. But yeah, it was a very interesting conversation. It's a very interesting conversation to have.
It is. And I'm going to say, my other story that I made the mistake of doing once, when I was actually doing consulting and implementation, was I was going out, I was going on site every other week. So flying out and renting a car, right? And when you do that, you obviously sign up to a loyalty scheme, so you get lots of points, so they start upgrading you. And after about 3 months, and actually when we were doing UAT testing, I got there and I booked like the standard like hatchback and like a Fiesta or something. And they're like, oh, Mr. Harris, because you've got so many points, we've upgraded you, and here's your Mercedes A-Class AMG. And I made the mistake of not only being seen by the project lead arriving at site in this car, of then getting into the room and being sat next to their boss and just, you know, as you do, putting stuff down on the desk to set up. And I put the car key fob down, and he looks and he went, very, very straight, we are paying you too much money. And I just was like, and I honestly, I went, I just, and I just, I've got brain. And then when we went for lunch, the project lead was there, and I was like, did you see that? They're like, yeah. I was like, they said, don't worry about it. And I said, look. And I sort of, I showed, because bear in mind as well, because I was going on site as the project, we were charging them my expenses. Because it's what you do, right? And I was like, no, look, this is it. And they were like, it's fine. And I was like, yeah, but they went, he was joking. And I was like, not that. I've not been doing it very long, and I felt very vulnerable. And I was like, no, genuinely. Yeah. And it's the same again when it's like, I just thought, no, I just do this a lot. I promise.
I swear. I swear I'm not charging you for having a fun toy to ride.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I had, funnily enough, was speaking of the car, because that's also part of your dress code. If people are going to see the type of vehicle you come in, that's also a signal that you're giving people. And I remember, so this is, again, so I started VMware during the pandemic. The first time me meeting my then boss face to face, we met up at a cafe, like a little bit around like the area where I was living at. And he was very kind to like drive all the way down, because he was in York. He drove down to meet up with me. And I remember it was like a little, because it was like a roadside, like little cute cafe that I found on, on Google Maps. And I parked my nice, mind you, nice little Corsa, like on this empty parking lot, to which the sparkliest, shiniest sports Audi comes through, parks right next to my Corsa. And in my head, Paul, I'm like, who is this douchebag? This sparkly nice car in the middle of nowhere, like, oh my god, I'm too close. And I was thinking, like, oh, I'm so close to Cornwall, like this is definitely like some rich, whatever. And like, and then pops out my boss. And I'm like, oh no. Right, I was laughing as he was coming in, and I said, hello, and I was, very happy to see him in person, yada yada yada. And I couldn't help myself, but I actually told him, like, do you know what was my first impression when I saw you come in? And I told him the story, and he's like, yeah, is that yours? Like, the Corsa. And I'm like, yeah. And sort of he did the same thing of, like, the same thing as the customer, that's like, just looking it up and down. And went like, oh, you need to get yourself a new car. Like, what? What do you mean I need to get myself a new car? And I'm like, it's practically brand new. Like, it was like, in my eyes, it was like 6 years old. Like, that's not sparkly brand new, coming from a 16-year-old car. And I'm like, the rims are alloyed and the white and pretty. Like, it's a really lovely car. And he's like, yeah, no, you need to pick either, pick your weapon of choice. You either need an Audi, a BMW, or a Mercedes. So go, go get yourself, like, your job for next week is to go to, like, a car dealership that has all three. Give them a go, see which one you like, and buy yourself one. I'm like, and he's like, I'm paying you enough to be able to do that. Like, it's part of your car allowance. Like, just, make sure everything fits within that car allowance. Like, the payment for the car plus the insurance. And just go get yourself something nice. I hate him so much still for this, because it's his fault that I like Audi. And he sort of like looked at me for a while and went like, and you're gonna get yourself an Audi. And I'm like, I'm not gonna get it. And I spent, again, there is a stereotype with Audi drivers, both in Bulgaria and in the UK. And I'm like, oh no, I'm not gonna become an Audi driver. And lo and behold, I got myself an A3 the next week. And that did matter, right? Because as long, especially coming in as the representative of a big American IT company that owned over 90%, that's where, like, I think I've mentioned this before, it's a very strange like language thing coming in from a big vendor like that, where we didn't refer to people as prospects, they were customers. Because everyone was our customer already. We were just upselling them other things. So as I was going to customer sites, they had an expectation, not for the dress code of looking fancy, they had an expectation that this person is working for a company that pays well. So it needs to be part of the image. And it definitely was a thing. Because, it absolutely was a thing. Because I remember I remember going to partner sites, right? Like going to meet partners, for example. And it was like my car was always parked because it was on the guest side. And that's usually also where all the leadership team of the partner organization would park as well. And like my car would be, not a Porsche, which most of them were, but like it was fitting in there. So it wasn't like I was driving my, at the time would be 8-year-old Corsa in there. But and that was the expectation, that you would come in with a nice car. And it was also the really funny thing, and this was one of the partners mentioned it to me. Oh, you can tell which cars are the engineering cars and which ones are the sales guys' cars. Because like you would have a row of BMW, Audi, like, you know, German cars. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you have a Porsche, a Jaguar, right next to it. And it's like, yeah, those are the sales guys, and these are your guys' cars. It's like, oh, that's a funny thing. I wonder why that is.
I can't get away from... have come from a place where being told if you turn up in a really nice car by people who have very nice cars, turning up in a really nice car when you're selling something sends the wrong message, and it will psychologically, people will try and drive the price down. Similarly, if you walk through a car park that's full of fancy cars, you'll add 30% to your price because you go, well, they're clearly a company that's doing well for themselves. But I also can't get away from, and this is like when I was like 12 doing a paper route, and the first one I did was a gated estate, and this is a gated house on a gated estate. There were 8 garage doors. Half of them were double garages because I saw them open at one point, right? The swimming pool, very nice person, I didn't see them very nice, but parked outside the house by the fountain that they had was a Fiesta, and it was beaten up. And I spoke to him once, and he said, yeah, he was like, my money is in the house. And he's in this. He's like, why would I put money into a car that I take down the road every day? And I think that's also in my head, is I'm like, yeah, I could. And one day I'm sure I will get a nice car, but it's, I have a very functional outlook on them currently, going, yeah, I could, but I don't need to spend £600 a month on a car that's going to massively depreciate. So I don't know, it's a whole other thing.
AI therapy,
because it's been a month in AI. I could have picked any number of stories about this. And I suppose I would preface this by what sort of happened last Friday in the global markets, and which seems to have been slightly getting better. Bear in mind, we're recording in the first full week of August. So, you know, some people calling it AI's Black Friday. I'm not so sure if that's what it was. Essentially, there were some quite bad results for companies that are making quite heavy investments in AI. Companies like Microsoft and Google and Amazon, who revealed that their CapEx spend in AI is the biggest spend, and they don't yet know how to monetize it. And all of a sudden people went, oh, what? You're spending our money on stuff that, So there's that, right? There's this, and it's not that the bubble has burst. I just think that the AI balloon just has the air going, slowly, kind of going out of it a little bit, and it's this thing of, oh, okay. And yeah, there's going to be Search GPT from OpenAI, which is going to kind of supposedly rival Google. But again, there's a whole, I feel like there's now, people are sort of cottoning on to the like philosophical problems of AI and the environmental, right, and, you know, sort of that side of it, maybe there's technology which is using a huge amount of energy to run, and which is very complex to have parts that are produced. There's that piece, right? But that's not the fun stuff.
Right.
The fun stuff is, and I would recommend, if listeners don't, to check out Decoder from The Verge, because it has some great interviews with CEOs on there. It's very entertaining, you know, hearing car CEOs talk about why they think that people won't want to use CarPlay. Come on, everyone just wants to use CarPlay. But the best ones recently have been, two, right? First one was the CEO of Zoom, who said that his vision for the company is that Zoom will have AI twins, digital twins of you, that will attend meetings in your place. Which obviously has a logical conclusion of, well, what if you have a meeting that's just AI? It's just, like, what's the output of that, right? That's the one story. The other one was the Logitech CEO talking about the idea of a AI-enabled forever mouse. A mouse, as in a computer mouse, that you pay a subscription. Uh-huh. A subscription, right? Because they would release features for the mouse. I've had this mouse for 7 years. It has a button that brings up like that's the Windows key that I never use, right? Apart from that, I like it because it's ergonomic.
I have a, for folks that are listening, I have a vertical mouse, which is for, for ergonomic reasons, because I had some problems with my hands for a very long time. And I'm just sitting here staring at it, almost expecting for it to start talking at me to explain to me the reason of why in God's name will I need to, for this to be a subscription.
Recurring revenue. Right. I just
sell nice mice. Like, you replace mice, and especially keyboards and things. Like, you replace them all the time. Like, Logitech, just do cool stuff, and I will continue. This is a Logitech one, by the way. Like, just keep on making cool stuff. Like, I have, and this tangent, maybe not for AI Corner, but, like, I have so much, like, extra keyboards and mice and, like, other input devices that I would continue to pay good money for every couple of years. Is that not enough? Exponential growth, capitalism. Stop with the subscriptions for everything. Anyway, back to AI.
That's it. Right. I think that's it. It feels like we are at this point where if you're a tech CEO and you want to make your product sound compelling, you go, it's AI enabled, and you attach a subscription to it. And I'm just like, I keep feeling like we're getting to the point. And credit here to Will Aitken on LinkedIn for doing the meme that I feel like everyone should have done, which is the, if you're familiar with Scooby-Doo, and it's the, like, pulling the mask off of the thing, and it's like, we are AI enabled, and you just pull off the mask and it's just a ChatGPT API, right?
Is this a bad point, by the way, Paul, that obviously in the spirit of capitalism, I would like to make an announcement.
Okay.
That Lydia's coaching services are now AI enabled. You haven't been speaking to Lydia this entire time. You have been speaking to her twin that now has a fringe, and everything has been completely and wholeheartedly generated by AI. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
$20 a month, please.
I feel like the
for your continual usage of coaching and friendship, coaching and friendship capabilities.
is there an annual plan available? Oh, you get free discount.
Three year plan,
minimum term.
It's perpetual light.
It feels like we are coming back to where we got to, like, 2 years ago. Before, like, just before AI, you remember everyone was talking about the blockchain and crypto and how that was going to change everything. And then we went, hang on a minute, it's it doesn't make any money and it's super expensive. And then AI came along and everyone got really excited. And I think there are still some very, very tedious applications of AI. And I will admit, right, here on this podcast, to you and to Tim, I've used an AI voice, like, generator relatively recently for some work stuff to do a voiceover, and it was because it was like I was kind of guided to do it, so I'm gonna be like, yeah, there's that person over there told me to. Miss, that it was there, it was them, they told me to do it.
Is it you? It's you, that's a lie. You have been using AI for this AI podcast recording.
Yes, of course. Every time you speak to me, it's just you're just
oh my lord.
Yeah.
That makes so much sense. That's how you can get everything done all at the same time. That's how you're training for a freaking triathlon or whatever it is that you're training for. Ultra marathon, sorry. You have two kids, a wife, a house, and you're building a deck, and you're working, and you're doing this. I knew it. I knew you couldn't be that productive.
No, no one could be that productive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, that's it. I just think it's big close. But I just think, you know, this, the future, the Wandering Tech, now brought to you by AI.
Please pay us £20 a month versus the subscription. Thank you. Thanks so much for listening, Tim. You and I both know that podcasts have a really hard time getting any sort of reach. So if you can do us a big favor, if you enjoy listening to the Wandering Tech podcast, leave us a feedback on your preferred listening platform. A like, a 5-star review, a comment, or even better, recommend us to a friend. Maybe that special Tom in your life. We really appreciate you, and we're working on growing the podcast. You can find both me, Lydia Vasilova, and Paul as Paul Harris on LinkedIn, and see more around what we are up to at solutionspathfinders.com. That is solutionspathfinders.com. Thank you.